From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Thank you, Simon Marks. Welcome to Wednesday's programme. It is a pretty miserable day in Salford. Horrible weather in the northwest of the country. So it's nice and cosy in studio. Welcome.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
Yeah, that presidential debate was some shit show, eh? We might get into that with Gerald Celente a little bit later on. Why not? Why not, I say?
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yes, he publishes the legendary Trends Journal fortnightly, trendsresearch.com. My old and dear friend Gerald Celente will be with me this hour. Don't miss him. And in the second hour, we're off to Philadelphia. A very well-respected lady, a mother and an activist by the name of Alison McDowell will join the programme. She's been paying attention for some years to the corporatisation of everything. And she's been studying the World Economic Forum's stated aim to bring about the fourth industrial revolution. And that is tied into the COVID-19 pandemic. Wrenchinthegears.com, wrenchinthegears.com. Alison McDowell in the second hour. You don't want to miss her. I've been watching her on YouTube and elsewhere. Fascinating lady. Very bright in the second hour. How are you, by the way? Hey, have you got a dog? Have you? Are you getting wet as well? Tis the season. For it is the season. Well, as you might have heard in the news there, Lindsay Hoyle, sir, if you please, the Speaker of the House, recently appointed after John Bercow rebuked the government for riding roughshod over parliamentary procedure and not allowing Parliament to scrutinise measures to deal with COVID. Anyway, after all of that, at Prime Minister's questions, Matt Hancock, the Health Secretary, promised MPs that they would get votes, wherever possible, on England or UK-wide coronavirus regulations before they come into force. But he warned, we can't hold up urgent regulations needed to control the virus and save lives. Would you like to hear a bit of him? They were debating renewing the Coronavirus Act today, which gave this government unprecedented powers back in March. In March, they said we'll have it for 6 months, these powers. Now they want to renew them for another 6 months. Here is the Health Secretary, Matthew Hancock.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And I beg to move the motion to renew the Coronavirus Act. When we first introduced the Act back in March, I said that coronavirus is the most serious public health emergency that the world has faced in a century. And now, 6 months later, it is still the most serious public health emergency that the world has faced in a century.
But it's only been 6 months, so even if it is the most serious health emergency faced in a century, if it is, if we take your word for it, there hasn't been much time for another crisis to come along. Not much of an orator, is he, really?
And while we've made huge strides in expanding testing and huge progress towards a vaccine, with the virus still at large, so this coronavirus
at large
virus act and the measures within it remain as important as then. Our strategy is to suppress the virus while protecting the economy, education and the NHS until a vaccine makes us safe.
Until.
And this act is still needed to keep people safe.
We need the act until a vaccine arrives that will keep us safe. Yes. Right, okay. So what about giving MPs more of a say going forward? Remember, the very influential backbench committee, the 1922 committee, led by Sir Graham Brady, threatened to derail the government's plans to renew the Coronavirus Act. They were openly saying they would vote against it. Has he appeased them? It seems like he has. Here he is, Hancock, on giving them more of a say, Parliament, that is, in the future.
Now, this has been an unprecedented time. This House has had to do many unprecedented things, many of which have been uncomfortable. I've listened to the concerns raised about the scrutiny. And as you pointed out earlier, Mr. Speaker, there have been times when this pandemic has challenged us all, and we have not been able to do this as well as we would have liked. I therefore propose that we change the approach to bringing in urgent measures, and I'm very grateful to all colleagues who we've worked with to come forward with a proposal that will allow us to make decisions and implement them fast, yet also ensure that they are scrutinised properly. Today, I can confirm to the House that for significant national measures with effect in the whole of England or UK-wide, we will consult Parliament. Wherever possible, we will hold votes before such regulations come into force.
Now, that's important. Would you like to hear that again? It's important. So all of these MPs were pissed off that the Coronavirus Act gave Hancock, well, it basically gave Chris Whitty, Chief Medical Officer, and Patrick Vallance, Chief Scientific Advisor, it gave them the powers to do whatever they wanted at the drop of a hat, right? And they wanted more scrutiny, Parliament. So this is what he's offering them.
I can confirm to the House that for significant national measures...
National measures.
...with effect in the whole of England or UK-wide...
UK-wide.
...we will consult Parliament wherever possible. We will hold votes before such regulations come into force.
But I'm not the brightest spark in the world. But surely that just means they implement stuff on a local level. You get me?
Of course, responding to the virus means that the government must act with speed when required, and we cannot hold up urgent regulations which are needed to control the virus and save lives. I am sure that no member of this House would want to limit the government's ability to take emergency action in the national interest, as we did in March, and we'll continue to involve the House in scrutinising our decisions in the way my right honourable friend the Prime Minister set out last week, with regular statements and debates, and the ability...
Yes, so I can't believe that Graham Brady and the other cross-party MPs who were cheesed off, I can't believe this has appeased them, but it has apparently... When there is legislation to come in that we want to bring in on a national UK-wide level, we will go back to Parliament. But that just means they can do it locally, which they've been doing anyway over the last few weeks, haven't they? Imposing local lockdowns here, there and bloody everywhere. This is feckery. Can we get an Irish singer to sing What Kind of Feckery Is This? So he was going through the Coronavirus Act, the five main provisions of it. And he came to the third one. Listen up.
Mr. Speaker, the third part of the Act contains measures to suppress the virus. And as a nation, we've of course succeeded in suppressing this virus once, thanks to so many sacrifices by so many people. But with the cases on the rise, we know that there is more that needs to be done, and we need to do it together. Our central strategy of suppressing the virus while protecting the economy and education and the NHS until a vaccine arrives is underpinned by this part of the Act.
Until a vaccine arrives.
It gives us stronger powers to restrict or prohibit events and public gatherings and, where necessary, to shut down premises. It gives police and immigration officers the power to isolate a person who is or may be infectious. And it allows us to close educational settings or childcare providers. Again, these are not measures anyone wants to use, but we must keep them in place for the moment, because we need every weapon in our arsenal to fight this virus.
Just in case you missed it.
It gives police and immigration officers the power to isolate a person who is or may be infectious.
Yeah. The police and immigration officers can say, "Think you might be infected there, lad," and can detain you. So every day, seriously, every single day, new COVID rules come into force around the country. Every day. This is the essence of the Coronavirus Act. You might have heard the term statutory instruments being bandied around the media. It gives the government the ability to change the law on a whim, day to day. No need for approval. Crazy, right? An example, a great example, is new rules on singing in pubs, which came into effect the other day. And those new singing rules are, well, they're different, dear listener, depending on where you are in the country. You know, and this has led to folks living on their nerves. They don't know whether they're coming or going. So on Radio 5 Breakfast this morning, Nikki Campbell asked this question to human rights barrister Adam Wagner. What the bloody hell is going on? Can anybody explain these new rules? Adam Wagner.
It's a real muddle. In fact, I'd say it's a real mess because we've now got this very complicated sort of patchwork of regulations that apply all across the country. And if you're in the Northeast, you'd have to know what you're doing is legal or not. You'd have to know about your regulation, the Northeast regulations, which are called the Northeast and Northwest regulations. You need to know about the face covering regulations, the self-isolation regulations, the national regulations, the regulations which now ban singing and dancing in pubs and restaurants. So that's another thing for the Northeast. If you're in the Northeast, you can no longer sing. You can no longer sing in groups of six.
Can you sing in the South?
You can nationally. You can sing in the South. You can sing in a pub in a group of up to six. In the Northeast, you can only sing in a pub on your own.
Yeah.
What kind of fuckery is this?
What was that again?
In the South, you can sing in a pub in a group of up to six. In the Northeast, you can only sing in a pub on your own.
Wow. There is a very simple way of explaining this. Let's ask the Jewish Elvis. Let's get the Jewish Elvis involved. Jewish Elvis, can you explain pubs in the Northeast now?
Hand.
Come on.
Touching hand.
Lovely.
Reaching out. Touching me. Touching you.
Fantastic. Pubs in the Northeast and in the South, Jewish Elvis. Yeah.
The child never sings so good.
So good. They only had to ask the Jewish Elvis. There's no end to this madness because they continued, did Nicky Campbell and Adam Wagner, the human rights barrister. No end to it.
You can sing together. I think you can sing together outside in a group of up to six, but nationally.
This is fantastic, this. This is Monty Python. This is the Goons. This is Dave Allen. This is the Carry On crowd. Kenneth Williams. All rolled into fucking one, this. This is vaudevillian. I lack the vocabulary. I don't have the knowledge to describe how I feel about this. This is so fucking ridiculous. I mean, it's absolutely vaudeville. This is a human rights barrister live on the radio saying stuff like this.
You can sing together. I think you can sing together.
I think
outside in a group of up to six.
Up to six.
But nationally, you can sing together in a group of six.
Nationally, you can sing together in a group of six.
Inside.
But you don't have to stand together to sing. You can be quite far apart. That group of six could join another group of six, socially distance. You know, because it looks two groups of six, and they can all together sing a song of sixpence.
Yeah, I mean, don't shoot the messenger, but this is these are the rules.
You're the guy with
these
the brain.
Are the rules. Yeah, well, I mean, I've not made these rules, and these rules. I mean, I just think they're super complicated. They're coming out every few days in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
They're not being scrutinised by Parliament.
No.
I think it's, you know, it's really messy, and it makes it extremely difficult for people to understand. You know, even lawyers who obsess over these things, let alone just an ordinary person who wants to know whether they can, who they can go to the pub with, and, you know, who they can sing with, or whatever.
It's not complicated. The Jewish Elvis just explained it. If you're in the North, right? If you're in the North.
Touching hands.
And if you're in the South, so good. Right, simple as that. Madness. Madness. There is a serious side to it, though. The laws, we're laughing at them, but you could get into serious trouble, he says.
These are laws. So these are laws. So just to be really clear, Nicky, if you break these laws, you can be on the hook for fines of hundreds of pounds. Or if you break the self-isolation rules, which came into force a couple of days ago, you can get a fine of up to £10,000. So they're really, you know, and you can get a criminal conviction. So they're no joke. They really, you know.
A criminal conviction. Fantastic. You know, imagine porridge. Imagine doing a bit of bird. You come in, you get that lice delousing shit thrown all over you, and then you get your Bible handed to you by the Shawshank guy, and you go in amongst the prison population. First thing they ask is, what are you in for? I was singing in a pub. You evil bastard. But the laws are serious, and if you fall foul of them, you could have a life-changing fine.
If the police are going to enforce them, or local councils, then you can be in really serious trouble. You can get a really big life-changing fine. So it's no joke, and I think it's really difficult for people to get their head around them.
Yes, on tenterhooks. People are tripping out of their minds. They don't know what's going on. They can't figure it out. And maybe we've heard from guests, we've heard from various, I suppose, talking heads in the mainstream media talking about their belief that this is deliberate to keep people hopping around from one leg to the next. A Donkey Oti on Twitter asks a very salient point. Where does the North start in the UK? A good question, that. I don't know. Hi to Mad Monk, who's listening in Canada. How you doing, son? Hi to Liz. How you doing, Liz? Hi to Stuart, the left hand of God. Hi to Alan, Bass Ninja. How you doing, pal? Daz says, I just tuned in, Richie, and glad to hear the brilliant Kevin Myers has a book out. He does, and he'll be on the programme right soon to talk about it. Hi to Seamus as well. Hi to Faisal. Hi to Lepa. Hi to Patricia. Patricia says, this is all so hysterical that I'm sure writers of comedy shows and movies are all taking notes. Yes. Jean Ann has made the point to me. Spike Milligan and others would be in their element watching this garbage as it unfolds in front of our eyes. The wonderful Gerald Salente will be with me in a few minutes from Brooklyn. Yonkers, Brooklyn. It's Brooklyn. The Trends Journal is published twice a month, so it's fortnightly. It is brilliant. Trendsresearch.com. And I am really looking forward to, I mentioned this earlier on, speaking to Alison McDowell in the second hour of the programme. Thanks to her for reaching out to me, but a number of listeners had been in touch with me to ask me to invite Alison on as well. It's 20 minutes, just gone 20 minutes past five in the UK anyway. And this is your Richie Allen radio show. Let's have a tune from Aztec Camera. Why not? A bit of 80s for you. I like this. Back in a few minutes. Aztec Camera on there, the Richie Allen radio show. I am aware that Boris Johnson has been giving a briefing at Downing Street, flanked by Tweedledum and Tweedledee, or the Chuckle Brothers. What are they called again? Witty and Valance. This began at 5 p.m. just as I came on air. As I understand it, nothing groundbreaking in this briefing. Basically, Johnson, apparently, according to the BBC, has been telling the watching audience that the new measures being brought in will take time to feed through to the general public. That's at least what I'm getting. All righty. Shall we go to New York then? Let's go to New York City. My guest this hour, well, he doesn't need much introduction. You know him well. Trends in the news, by the way. If you want to get a good kind of a grip or a grasp on what's going on, not just with coronavirus and the measures, but also with the economy and geopolitical affairs, Trends in the News is a tonic because it's very funny at times and we all need a laugh, but it's also very on point. Trendsresearch.com is where you'll find links to subscribe to the journal, which comes out, of course, fortnightly. It's brilliant. Let's welcome back to the programme our great friend, the one and only Gerald Salente. Welcome back, my friend. How are you?
Thank you for having me back. But how am I? I'm feeling rotten, miserable, depressed.
And that's before you even start talking about last night's presidential debate, which I was going to open with. There are words that I suppose I shouldn't use because they are swear words and you're supposed to maintain some level of composure. But that was a pretty weird watch last night. I know you've been across it. What did you make of it?
Well, you know, go back. You're getting the Trends Journal, right?
I am. Thank you.
Yeah. So go back to yesterday's that went, you know, it's a weekly, as you mentioned.
A weekly, excuse me.
75 pages, 76 pages.
Yeah.
Here's the letter to the subscribers. This went out at 8 o'clock, you know, Eastern time. The debate began at 9. Welcome to this week's Trends Journal Presidential Reality Show, the Presidential Reality Show, Masks versus No Masks. Right on trend, Anthony Frieda's cover sums up what the race for the White House is all about. And tonight's debate, and then we have in parentheses, or freak show,
yeah,
will be one of the critical events that decides the winner of the presidential reality show, who will win the race, blah, blah, blah. We go on. A freak show, all right? I said it was a freak show before the freaks hit the stage. I want to make this very clear to anybody that has a brain bigger than a pea, and of course you do, or else you wouldn't listen to Richie Allen or me. Yeah. That's why you're tuned in, so I don't have to tell you, but you could tell this to other people. The fish rots from the head down. Look at the low-life pieces of top fish that are going to be president of the United States. Look at these two low-life freaks putting on the presidential reality show yesterday. What a joke. A sick joke. How am I feeling? I feel like crap. I feel like crap from all of these low-life pieces of garbage crap that are perfectly, perfectly visualized by Biden and Trump. No, we'll call it Macron. No, how about little Boris Johnson? No, 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 Angela Merkel. She's a woman. I like her. No, no, why don't we just keep going around? How about that Sanchez, that other piece of crap over there in Spain? Go around the world. That's all. These. What happened last night is a perfect representation of all the political freaks that are leading you to misery.
It's astonishing to me that with everything that's going on, that people invest themselves so much in it. You see social media today awash with criticism of what is the guy's name, Wallace, the Fox News guy who chaired this. You have Trump's mob mobilized like never, you know, even more mobilized. You've got Biden's mob mobilized up in arms. And I can't figure out why, and you've been doing what you've been doing for years, why people can't see that it doesn't matter. That either way, you get a president, either way, whose foreign policy will be dictated by the state of Israel, and either way, you get a man who will attempt to force a vaccination on the population in the name of keeping them safe while wrecking the economy to do so. The Journal is brilliant. I don't butter you up, you know that. It's sent to me every week. It's terrific. It's always on point. It's always right. What more needs to happen before people understand all of these people you named brilliantly, Johnson, Merkel, Sanchez, all of them, are merely puppets for a bigger agenda? What needs to happen for them to figure it out?
What needs to happen? All aboard. Next train to Auschwitz. All right. What do you think the people? Don't raise your voice, Salenti.
Yeah.
Don't be angry. All aboard. What are you kidding? Don't fight. People aren't fighting. In America, it's dead. These two clowns were the perfect representation of what America's become. At least they're having rally protests in Trafalgar Square. And what about almost a million Germans took to the streets a couple of weeks ago, yeah, in protest of these draconian lockdowns by the dictators? Not in America. Not in America. They rat you out. It's the United Soviet States of America. Do you know the crap I got when I held that rally to unite for peace and restore freedom on the 4th of July?
I remember.
Yeah. I invited Black Lives Matter. They didn't come because I'm on Alex Jones' show from time to time. Well, I just finished Progressive Radio Network just before I got on your show, but that's okay. Oh, and I had Judge Napolitano up here. He's from Fox. Yeah. That's okay for them to march. They don't have to come. And by the way, I want to make this 100% clear. Biden's picking Kamala Harris is sexist and racist. They picked a black woman to get votes. I don't care. I'm in business. I run a business. I don't care if they're black. I don't care if they're white. I don't care if they're yellow. I don't care if they're transgender, inside out, upside down. I want the best person to do the job. How dare you pick somebody because you're looking for benefit to yourself? When I, you little low-life piece of crap that everybody forgets, you're public servants. You got it? You got it? I'm paying you, you piece of crap. I want the best person. Why, you racist and sexist, Salenti. That's the kind of slime balls I got living around me. They call themselves liberals. What liberals? Do you know the crap that I got? I was on a radio station up here, and I can mention the name Woodstock.
Yeah.
And I came out against the draconian measures being forced upon us by little Andy Cuomo. Little Andy Cuomo, a little nobody of a boy if daddy wasn't Mario. Again, it's one big club and you ain't in it. But moving forward, I said these are Nazi dictates that they've put on us. New York is dead. New York City's a ghost town. It's dead. It's destroyed. Anyway, you know the crap I got for using the word Nazi?
Yeah.
And how dare I say Nazi? And I'm disrespectful to the Jewish people? Oh, they dumped all over me because these little low-life, slimy, gutless people who love Andy Cuomo, only 33,000 people died in New York State. Yeah, yeah, about the same as Spain with 46 million people, more than Spain, and we only have 19.5 million people, but we'll move on from that. But it's okay for Biden to call Trump a Nazi. So when you ask me about what's going on, that's who lives up here. That's who's here. All these Woodstock people that protested and was anti-establishment, they bend over and take it up there right away. I'm a Democrat. I'm a liberal. You're a piece of crap. How can you look up to this slightly little boy Cuomo that's destroyed us? And it's all over. It's one country after another. They're fighting. They're fighting in Spain. They're fighting in England. They're fighting in Germany. They're fighting in France. But not in America, the land of the gutless. Look what the people look like. Why are so many dying here? Huh? Oh, couldn't be because of pre-existing chronic conditions. 2.6 of 94% of the people who died from COVID had. Oh, look at America, huh? Yeah, 42% of the people are obese. 70% are overweight. Type 2 diabetes, obesity, major killers for COVID. Look what this country looks like. Oh, I'll tell you when Black Lives Mattered. Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, who, by the way, put on a show when I was a major guy running a trade association back in the late 1970s, and she was our keen, you know, she'd entertain the folks. Look at the style and grace they had. America's music, jazz, from ragtime to swing to rhythm and blues and rock and roll, Motown, and now it's a bad rap. Look at me, but look at me. All right, that's where it is now. Look where it was. Every young cat, every cool hip person looked up to the black cats back in the day. They were leading the charge. America's music was its greatest export. Gone.
But aren't we guilty? I said similar things about grime music in the UK, but I'm a 45-year-old white guy. Aren't we guilty of that old trap of saying in our day music and culture was so much better? I mean, for young men, whether it's black men in America, black men in London, this is their music, this is how they express themselves, and it must be good because it sells well.
It's not fair, no. Burger King sells well. McDonald's sells well. Junk food, junk music, junk news, it sells well. I got the best one for you to sell well. How about fear? Oh, does fear. Fear is a big seller. The COVID war, we're marching off to the COVID war. I'm saying how great America used to be. And it was terrible what they did to the black people, the segregation. I remember as a kid, my sister, who's in a nursing home that I can't go see. I'm like 13 years old. She takes me down to Virginia Beach. And because I was going, you know, going through some tough times as a kid, like we all do. So anyway, I had a great sister. We get on the ferry. This is before they built the bridges out of Maryland to go to Virginia. And I see the water fountain says for whites only and the bathroom for whites only. I'm 13 years old. So it was terrible, the racism in America back then. Not in all over, but, you know, so they went through tough times. The toughest times that they went through, they gave us, that has to be one of America's greatest treasures. Cab Calloway. As I said, Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, one after another. And now look where we've gone. The whole country's gone down. From the roaring 20s to the regretful 2020s.
Listen, you've known me a long time. You know I'm no virtue signaler. I don't understand rap music any more than I understand, you know, operas. And my better half is a great musician and loves opera. But there would be listeners now listening to us and they would say, Richie, people like Tupac Shakur and Jay-Z and Lil Wayne and Kendrick Lamar, these guys are poets, they would say.
Yeah.
And they would say, guys like you and Celente, you wouldn't know anything about it, they would say.
I don't give a damn what they say. I'll tell you when it died. I'll never forget. It was going down to, it was down the city, the Italian Little Italy. And blah, blah, blah. This guy, he's a big guy with the, this early 1980s, with one of the music businesses. He was so happy because now they didn't have to hire bands. It was just starting. They could use technology instead of music. They can make it sound like it, but it's not really it. Take it easy, Jack, I said. It ain't the same. Yes, it is. I said, no, it doesn't have a heart. It doesn't have a soul. It doesn't have a breath. It doesn't have a human touch. I don't want to hear your rap. I want some music too. I got my own rap. Take it easy, Jack. I want to have a good time. And that's what it used to be.
I love arguing with you because you've got a very thick skin. That's a subjective view. I mean, I'm the same. There is a movement in this country. It's called grime, and I can't stand it. But that's my subjective point
Again,
of view. It's
not
because I'm racist.
They don't have the heart and soul in it.
According
they
to you,
they don't have instruments in it.
Yeah.
So if your life is to be a tech slave, and you get off on that, knock yourself out. But don't tell me that. I have a fine glass of wine here that took a lot to make and it really put a lot of passion into it. That's as good as your Coca-Cola. It's a big seller, I know. So it doesn't have the human spirit in it.
Celente is not backing down.
It doesn't have the instruments in it.
Yeah. And yet I have friends who love it. Listen, let's...
I don't care what they love. I could care less. I'm just saying...
Well, thanks very much.
look back then. Look how the people were dressed. Look at the style. Look how low it's gone. If you like looking at fat crap, sloppy dressed, knock yourself out. I surround myself with beauty.
No.
I write about the ugliest crap in the world. I have over 100 plants in my office. I water all of them. I have gardens. I take care of them. I have artwork. I surround myself with beauty. If you don't like beauty, anybody, great. Not my trip.
Not you.
America was a land of beauty one time. It's gone. It's gone. Again, all you had to do was tune in to the presidential reality show, How Low Can You Go?
Lunacy last night.
Art to me is the way of finding the true meaning of the human spirit.
Listen,
and
I can hear.
Anybody listening forgot, there was a thing called the Renaissance. And the Renaissance followed the Black Plague. Because the smart people realized the reason we're dying is because we're so damn stupid with our new world that we're killing ourselves a la Romana Antica in the manner of the Romans and the ancients. They then did to describe the work that they did. They went back to the great, a renaissance, a rebirth. So if people want to live in the crap that they're in and you love that Domino's pizza, want to go to Olive Garden, oh, I like Starbucks,
yeah,
knock yourself out, save it, don't want to hear it.
Not for you. Gerald Celente is our guest. I'm giving you the final word out of respect for my seniors on the culture and on the music. I can hear my other half, who's French and who also loves beauty, I can probably just about hear her clapping in the room adjacent to the studio. She plays the sax, the clarinet. She's into her classical music, Chopin. She loves you, by the way. So tell me this. Let's get back on to more serious matters.
Well, that's a very serious matter.
Well, of course it is.
Because we need a renaissance.
Of music and culture.
If we don't have a renaissance, why am I so excited like this? Because we are on a point of destruction like it's unimaginable. And if anybody can match my track record, my books, my magazine, 40 years, and you could tell me you have a better vision and have the trademark, the facts to show it, I'll talk to you. I see hell on earth getting worse. You're going to see a civil war in America. You heard it last night. They won't know who wins this election maybe until March, April. There's going to be taking to the streets. But places are going broke all over the world. People are taken to the streets. They lock down society. They lock down businesses. They put hundreds of billions of people out of work. They destroy tens of millions of businesses. This thing is going to get so bad and out, and then you're going to get cracked down by your leader. Your leader is going to take control of your life.
28,000 people were fired from Disney parks today. I'm reliably informed by my good friend in Ireland, Jean Ann, and that speaks to...
It's in the Trench Journal, too, by the way.
In the Journal, yeah. I'm always honest, I haven't read this week's Journal.
I'm just saying, we even wrote about it as well.
Imagine that. I mean, we got into this last time, 28,000 people.
How about the airline industry?
Four million.
It's only operating at 85%.
Yeah.
Below 85, in other words, 15%. It's operating.
The BBC said today 4 million people are going to lose their jobs imminently because of the devastation.
Oh, it's all right. It's all right. It's all right. I'm a politician. I'll tell you what to do. I steal your money in the name of taxes. I've been sucking off the public tit all my life. Never worked a day in my life. I don't have to worry about money. I get it from you. I don't have to worry about a retirement program. I get it from you. I could give a damn about your health. I got the best policies. I get them from you, you little slave of Slavelandia. They could care less. We're going into World War III. This is erupting all over the world. If people don't fight now for freedom, they're going to die in war. The COVID war. That's what they called it when they launched it. And that's what we're fighting. We're fighting the COVID war. We're fighting the COVID war. Put on those masks. Socially distance. These are the same low-life pieces of garbage crap that had us hiding under desks in case an atom bomb went off.
Yeah, I remember you saying.
Yeah. Like that was going to make a difference. Oh, and when you're sitting down and outside or inside a restaurant, you don't have to eat with your mask up. But when you stand up, you got to put your mask up because that's when the virus comes. It doesn't come at table length. Or shove your crap up your you-know-what.
Why hasn't... Let's just take two industries. Let's take hospitality and aviation. And this is something which is plaguing me. Why... don't, realizing that their businesses are going down the toilet, why are we not seeing more business owners ignoring the ignoring these COVID measures and opening? What have they got to lose?
Well, they got to lose because you got a little slimer like Cuomo. You got them all over the world bringing the cops in there to bust you up. Look what they're doing over there in Australia. You saw, how about in the United States? They just lasered a woman for not wearing a mask at a high school football game with nobody in the stands.
Yeah.
And the other reason people aren't doing it because we're cowards. Hey, listen, I'm an old guy. I'm a little guy. And I fight. I put my money where my heart is. I launched that big rally. I put out a magazine. I worked tirelessly. A little guy, a fighter. Where are all you big guys and big women? I'm fighting. Oh, we're not going to fight. We're not going to fight. We're cowards. Oh, and you're being angry. Hey, let me get this straight. The Prince of Peace, who I'm a warrior of, became violent when he chased the money changers out of the temple. You got it? Oh, but you better be careful because, whoof, hanging on a cross just a couple of days later. But don't fight. Take orders. All aboard. Next train to Auschwitz.
You'd rather take a few lumps because you'd still be able to look yourself in the mirror, right? You'd rather take a chance and defend yourself and your business and your family, even if you knew the odds were stacked against you, because you couldn't live with yourself for doing nothing. And that's the way men used to be, but men are not like that anymore.
No. And again, you know, I'm 5'6" and a half. If I make it another month and a half, I'll be 74 years old. I fight. I used to teach close combat.
Yeah.
And I practice every day. If somebody breaks into my house, if they break in, I'll blow their damn brains out before they can blink an eye. If somebody tries to kill me, I'll kill them first. Does that mean that you win all the time? No. But I wasn't put on this earth to take orders or be violated by anybody. I'm a free man. That's why I bought these buildings on the Four Corners of Freedom, 1774, 1750, 1763 building. And that's why I launched Occupy Peace and the movements. I'm born to be free. Not me. I'm a Democrat. I'm a repulsive kin. I'm a conservative. I'm a liberal. You're dead in your mind. You got your little system that you belong to. And when I talked about Jesus Christ driving the money changers out of the temple, it hasn't changed. Look what just happened. It's in our Trends Journal. J.P. Morgan Chase just got fined $920 million for rigging the precious metals markets. Nobody goes to jail. A lousy, crappy $920 million when they did nothing. The hundreds of, probably billions of dollars they made. And they get a slap on the wrist. And you got to look like it. You got to put a Jamie Dimon out there. Right in front of you. Right in front of you. $920 million for rigging a fine. But hey, you went over the double yellow line. Get out of your car. Stand on your head. Repeat the alphabet backwards.
Yeah.
You're not wearing a mask. We're going to beat you up. But these little lowlives suck up to a Jamie Dimon. They give him a rip. They do anything in public. Those little clowns that do that to other people. And by the way, the police in Kingston, whew, real men and women, they don't bother you for little crap. They're from here. They love where they're from. It's not like what's happened in these big cities where you get these little boys and girls that want to play tough. So going back, why am I like this? Again, the banksters, the Wall Street gang, right in front of your eyes, they're too big to fail and too big to jail. Oh, who said they were too big to jail? Oh, that was Eric Holder. Oh, what color was he? Black? Oh, yeah, under Obama and Clinton? They were too big to jail. And America's not a racist nation. I want to make this 100% clear. Are they racist? Of course they are. Are they sexist? Yep. You don't elect a black president who's going to be the savior if you're a racist nation. And by the way, you like those shows called The Sopranos? You like those mobster movies? Oh, you could do that to the Italians. That's fine. I want to see a movie like that. Do it against the blacks. Hey, I want to see the Jewish thief movie, all right?
Yeah.
Show me that. Put that series on HBO. No, we only could do it to the Italians. Hey, how come there's no Italian presidents? Got a black president. Oh, we're guineas and wops. I forgot. All right, so I don't want to hear this crap anymore. People better stand up and fight for freedom, liberty, love, joy, and beauty, because we're living hell on earth.
74 next birthday. While you've been speaking there, I've been listening. I've just gone on to Amazon and I've bought you the greatest rap album of all time, Gangster Rap. And I'll be sending it to Kingston with a nice bottle of Irish whiskey, a bottle of Powers whiskey. I won't do that to you. Great to have you back on today. You're going to be coming on at least every month. We're going to make it a regular thing, which is great for us. You send me the journal. I'm not lying when I say I would buy it if you didn't send it to me. So thanks for sending it to me. Trendsresearch.com.
There's no magazine like it. There's no, there no magazine no. in the world that comes close to it.
No, there Nothing. Isn't. You can say that. And you talked about, you know, these culture wars leading to civil war. That's been in the journal for a long, long time before anybody else was talking about it. So I can endorse that. So brilliant, mate. Thanks for coming back. Trendsresearch.com, folks. Weekly subscribe to the journal. And we'll talk to Gerald again, I'm guessing, in a few weeks' time, maybe mid to late October, all going well. Maybe around the time of your birthday. Thanks again, mate. Love having you on. I really do.
Well, thank you. And please, everybody, do what you can to support us. The more we have, the more we can fight. It's as simple as that.
Top man, Gerald. Have a great rest of your day. And thanks for coming back. Gerald Celente, live from Kingston, New York, the Trends Journal, trendsresearch.com. Big thanks to him again. And to Karen, who's new there, who's been helping arrange the chats with Gerald. So hi to Karen as well. It's exactly 6 minutes to the top of the hour. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show live. It always is live. Lots of new listeners and some of them, many of them coming through Spotify. I get all of these statistics sent to me by Podomatic.com because I use Podomatic as my host. And they're a great group of people, Podomatic.com. I've been with them now for a few years. And they're great people, committed to free speech. It's a big deal, Podomatic.com. They host hundreds of thousands of podcasts. And time for a bit of bragging. The Richie Allen Show is number one in news and current affairs and overall. If you don't believe me, go to Podomatic.com. We get somewhere around 80 to 90,000 downloads a week through Podomatic. It's tens of thousands more through Spotify and iTunes. But Podomatic.com is where a lot of people grab the program Spotify. But if you are grabbing it and you are new, it is live every Monday to Thursday at 5 o'clock. Here in the UK, UK time. Why am I telling you that when you prefer to get it on demand? Well, if you want to interact with the programme and have your say while I'm on air, the way to do that is to listen live. Now, heads up, tomorrow, Thursday, which will be October 1st, I will be opening the phone lines. So you can Skype me tomorrow during the programme or phone me. Keep that in mind now. Skype or phone tomorrow, Thursday. Pretty much most of the programme. I might do 10 minutes of headlines and then I'll open the phones. And we haven't done that for a few weeks, so it's about time we did it again. You get to come on and say whatever you want to me. You can be as rude to me as you want. I don't mind. I can take it. I'll just be even ruder back. Or we can have a natter about whatever you think needs to be done, whatever you think is going on. We can get into all of that tomorrow. The phone-in show, that is tomorrow, Thursday, October 1st. All right, 5 o'clock every weekday. Monday to Thursday, anyway. Monday to Thursday. Here's that music from the Stranglers. I love this. Ah, the Stranglers, hey, God be with the days. It's about 60 seconds to the top of the hour. Let's have headlines, shall we? Let's have headlines from FSN. I think we should have headlines from FSN. And what I say goes, so here we are.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Republicans are accusing the moderator, Chris Wallace of Fox News, of fixing last night's TV debate following an evening that is being widely described as a low in US presidential history. The Speaker of the British Parliament is accusing the government of disregarding lawmakers over its handling of new measures aimed at combating COVID-19. And the first top executive linked to the Dieselgate scandal in Germany has been put on trial.
Thank you, Simon. Alison McDowell has logged in, and that's a good thing. She'll join us live in about 3-4 minutes' time. You don't want to miss her. It's going to be a fascinating conversation. This is your Richie Allen radio show. It is live from Salford. Here in the northwest of the UK, I am the BBG. This ain't the BBC. Do keep those comments coming in. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Back in 60 seconds' time.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbajerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
And it's really good to be chatting with you this Wednesday, miserable old day here in the UK. Shall we get Alison on the programme? Let's get her on. Let's get her on. Thanks to listeners who got in touch with me to recommend that I reach out to Alison. We were... I was chatting away with a friend of mine the other day, and he said, have you come across Alison McDowell? And I said, I have. I got a message from her. I've been looking at her YouTube videos. I've been on her website. I think she has a very good grasp of where things might be going and what this pandemic might be really all about. And you can use whatever term you want, scamdemic, hoax, whatever you want. So we connected, and I'm glad to say that she's with us this evening. She's a very well-respected activist, a mom first and foremost, and I believe that Alison's own journey began when she wasn't too happy with what she was seeing happening to her child's school, and we might talk about that in a minute. Now, she's been looking at the World Economic Forum and the stated aim to bring in the fourth industrial revolution and how that ties in with the Great Global Reset and what exactly, what part that COVID-19 plays in all of that. So I'm delighted to welcome her to the programme. Let's say hello to Alison McDowell. Alison, welcome to our show. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks so much for having me on today.
No, it's my pleasure. You're in Philadelphia, I believe.
I am.
A place I'd love to have visited. When I was in the States years ago, I went everywhere but Philly. And I'd love to visit that city of brotherly love, maybe one day, or maybe not, Alison, the way things are going. It's a bit crazy.
Know,
you never know. Please,
got
God.
A lot of good history. Exactly. Interesting history.
Great history. Absolutely right. So you're the corporatization, the privatization of everything. And you, by the way, Alison's website, folks, is wrenchinthegears.com. Wrenchinthegears.com. Please do check it out. Do bookmark it. It's packed with information and links to videos as well. Alison, it began with your child's schooling. Do you want to tell us about that?
Sure. Well, so my child graduated last year, but we had 13 years in the Philadelphia public schools. And as a public school district in a low income urban district, it was really a crucible for a lot of privatization efforts. And so for quite a while, I was just a mom. You know, I work half time, so I had time to volunteer and I would volunteer at the school. But then in 2013, Boston Consulting Group was brought in, and they decided to close 23 schools in our district, which is a huge number of schools. They laid off thousands of teachers. And then in the aftermath of all of this disruption, they decided to implement these school report cards, which would be grading schools. And the schools that are charter schools, which I guess are probably similar to like the academy schools in the UK,
yeah.
The ones that are sort of more reform minded and not within the public system, they wouldn't be held to the same rules. So in August, there was a meeting to sort of get the stamp of approval on this process. And they had it in late August so that all the parents would be gone. You know, usually here you can't get any kind of childcare at the end of August. So if you're going to plan a meeting for the end of August, it's because you don't want anyone to be there. And so we rallied a bunch of people and we showed up. It was supposed to be a series of six meetings, but to talk about these report cards. And we confronted them on how unjust it was. And then after that, they canceled all the remaining meetings and decided to have a focus group. But it turns out in this meeting that the report card program, and this was also a program of like a common application where you could apply to like many different kinds of schools, not public schools all at one go, was backed by the Michael and Susan Dell Foundation. And that's Dell Computers. And at the time, I naively thought it was about selling their devices and software, which I think in some respects it was, but it wasn't until later when I was watching the film about Edward Snowden, when he was asked to sort of justify himself, you know, in terms of his validity, and he threw down his Dell ID. And I realized that, oh, actually, it's not just about computers, hardware and software. It's really about data surveillance, and the NSA is one of the major contractors, one of Dell's major clients. And so that really put this idea of the use of technology in classrooms in a different light for me in terms of what it meant in terms of creating profit for private tech companies, but also what it meant in terms of controlling curriculum and really monitoring children, you know, in relation to that, as well as the disruption in terms of, you know, pushing towards leaner and leaner production and larger and larger class sizes and really harming the relational aspect of education.
That must have been, I won't say difficult to come to terms with, but it's a hard sell for people, isn't it? I mean, I would have made the connections that you initially made. Oh, they want to put products in the classroom. They want us to use their products. But you eventually got through all of that, realized that really this is about something far more sinister. You know, the data mining our children and conditioning our children, you know, in a way. When you mentioned their other parents, was that easy to discuss with other parents? Were they open to that possibility?
Well, there was a core group of folks. There was a group of many retired teachers and then some active teachers. I mean, parents are really busy. It's hard. Yeah. You know, if you're these days to get by, people are working long hours, multiple jobs. They just don't have time to sort of put into things. And then once you realize that things are broken on purpose, I mean, that I think that was the wake up call for me. For a while, I thought, well, oh, they just don't understand how wrong it is what they're doing. And when we can tell them, you know, and yeah. It will change. And then you realize, like, no, it's actually intentionally broken, and it's broken for a reason. You know, and I think the challenge for me for a number of years, because I got into focusing on opting out of high stakes testing, which we have a right to do in Pennsylvania where I live. I'm thinking that was a way out of withholding our data because it was all about the data, and realizing that it wasn't just that, and now it was going to morph into all the time testing with technology. But was in our school district, they would pit parents against one another. So they would like to sort of put parents in neighborhood schools against parents in magnet schools, against parents in charter schools, against parents who are in private schools, against parents who are unschooling or homeschooling or cyber schooling. They really want everybody in their different little boxes and saying, like, everyone thinking that their choice is the best choice.
Yeah.
And after all of these years doing this work, what I've realized is ultimately it's all going to come down to artificial intelligence deciding what children are able to learn as human capital. Like, that's the goal with the push ultimately for removing most bricks and mortar schools and moving to digital vouchers and online learning, is that even if you want to be outside the system entirely, the whole global economy is going to be built on these badges that are going to be tied into sort of behaviorist, Skinnerist performance measures on online platforms and increasingly wearable tech and virtual reality platforms. So all of us being pitted against one another and sort of feeling validated that our position was the best one wasn't ultimately helpful for what we're going to need to face moving forward, which is that how do we protect all children? And this is children in the US, children in the UK, children in Africa, children in India, against this level of predation, because it's happening. It's a matter of channeling global finance through their bodies as data, and that it's that we have to become unified at looking at it for what it actually is.
Can you explain that?
That really isn't a good way to get out of it.
This is, I'm not going to challenge this. I'm not going to jump all over you, because I've looked into this and it is happening. It's happening here as well. I know you're aware, I mean, you mentioned the academies here. So this is going on here. It's going on in lots of countries around the world. Explain what you mean, what you just said there about, you know, the surveillance of children and the commerce aspect of that. Can you explain right. that in lay terms? For me, I'm the sick guy. I'm the stupid guy here. I'm not saying that.
The thing is, not very many people know about it. And yeah. I would really encourage if folks, I have a YouTube channel. So if you look up Alison McDowell YouTube, it'll come up. Sandy Adams was there last Saturday in Trafalgar Square, and she actually spoke to it, which was really vital, because this is the piece that I think most people are not quite factoring into the equation, is this aspect of human capital finance.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's called pay for success. It's called social impact bonds or development impact bonds. And ultimately, this idea goes back in the United States to the mid-1990s, at least around outcomes-based government contracts, where this idea that you would have a performance-based contract of meeting some service delivery, and that if you met, you know, the performance metric, that you could have your payment. And so it's a pretty basic thing, unless you start to apply it to things like education, and then the performance metric becomes a score, and then everything becomes redesigned around these very narrow measures of quote unquote success. So we've had that going on in the background for quite some time. And now increasingly with data analytics and technology, we're able to implement it at a much wider scale. So in the UK, the central figure in a lot of this, his name is Sir Ronald Cohen. And he works with Big Society Capital, and he put together a financial product initially called the social impact bond. And the first one in the UK was, I believe it was 2010, and it was the Peterborough Prison. And it was around if you could provide an intervention, a social welfare intervention, that would limit the aspect of prisoners ending up reincarcerated. And again, this whole system is based on the fact that it's an individual's choice as opposed to structural elements that might lead to someone being put in a judicial system that, you know, it presumes it's all on the person rather than the society, the social aspect. But that was actually the first social impact bond that was done. And I would really encourage people to look into Sir Ronald Cohen and social finance, because what's happening is it's a colonial project. It's a large colonial project that's affecting Canada, the US, Australia, India, many other aspects through different divisions of social finance. And then it was brought by Michael Bloomberg and Goldman Sachs over to the United States, and they had a similar social impact bond at Rikers Island with youth in New York City. But then it expanded to education. And so the pay for success programs that relate to education are two main areas. One is early childhood, and that includes also home visits and prenatal care. That's a whole area of data collection and profiling. And then there's another section about workforce training and development, especially for what they call opportunity youth. So these are youth who are 16 to 24 who are not in school or employed. And so these are very big targets of human capital finance. And if you imagine what happened in 2008 with the global economic crash tied to real estate, what they had to do was create innovative products in the form of these asset-backed security, these mortgages, these toxic bundled mortgages, to essentially gamble on to run their capital, because the capital was becoming more and more concentrated into fewer and fewer hands, and more individuals were taking on more and more debt. And so to keep the capital flowing, the answer was to create these asset-backed securities tied to real estate. So of course that all fell apart. And in the 10 years after that, the wealth has only become more concentrated. And in many respects, the aftermath of that crisis has created many more social needs. People who have unstable employment, people who are housing insecure, people who are food insecure, people who are traumatized. The schools are falling apart because they don't have the tax base. So all of this is very tenuous. And now we're going to sweep in with the World Economic Forum and the United Nations, something called stakeholder capitalism. And this is tied in with the Great Reset. And this happened in January. So last January of 2019, they ushered in what they call Globalization 4.0, which is the advent of sort of the next wave of globalization and offshore labor and platform labor and robotic labor. That was the lead in. And then this year it was with all of the people who are displaced by this fourth industrial revolution system, we're going to create new instruments of finance to invest in people as human capital, right? Just the way you would have a municipal bond, essentially individual people become bonded through privatized social welfare services. And these social welfare services include everything from your education, your healthcare, your mental health care, your addiction treatment, your housing, your food stamps, your disability benefits, your elder care benefits, all of these things will ultimately be privatized with these public-private partnerships, the third-way partnership. Debt is securitized. It is then the next bundle of the mortgages. And so the education, the three nodes of data collection are education, healthcare, and housing. And so what COVID has done is it's created these vast markets for global investors, for people to become global investment commodities, including children.
Including children.
I don't know
children.
If that's layman's terms enough. Probably not.
This is some hard sell, this, isn't it, to people? I mean, it's terrifying when you look at it and you break it down the way you've broken it down and the speed.
You know what happened? I mean, at least yeah. I would say if you haven't watched the movie The Big Short, watch yeah. that movie, because they're very good at it. They explain it better than I did, how they did it to the housing. But now what they're going to do it, they're going to do it to toddlers.
Where do governments come into this, Alison? National governments.
Well, you know, what's really fascinating is that it's both sides, at least in the U.S. and I suspect in other places, people who are more liberal minded and people who are conservative, because they've threaded the needle, this third way, using a quote unquote fourth sector, which is this corporate NGO blend. On the liberal side, they'll say, well, people are getting taken care of. We like that, right? We like, but it comes at a very paternalistic cost, right? Because to be a digital commodity means you really start to lose free will and you have to live in a digital prison. On the conservative side, they'll say, well, we're willing to take care of people if we can prove that, quote unquote, it works. And you'll hear a lot of framing, at least in the US, about what works government, outcomes-based government, evidence-based solutions. And so on the conservative side, they'll say, well, we'll pay for it. We'll feel good about it as long as we can prove that it's working and transparent and accountable. But ultimately what that means is it's about gathering data and using data to profile people and to treat people as these commodities, which I think is a really horrific way because the wealth is so out of whack. The wealth is so concentrated in finance and technology. And all of this is fundamentally, this is what I would say is militarized. And it's also racialized. So, you know, I'm in this because I can see this is a trajectory coming from all the way to Doctrine of Discovery. You know, the Vatican Bank is very much involved in all of this and other faith communities, but that other people are lesser than, right? And that's rippled through the U.S. Our country has been built on land theft and genocide and enslavement and all of these things that are now we're at this consequence of now we're all in the crosshairs. Right.
All
you know,
of
the wealth
yeah.
concentrated with Jeff Bezos and, you know, Ellison and all of, you know, Musk and everyone, that they've got all the money and they're going to run it through us in the police state.
And culture wars and identity politics are even more futile when you see where this is going, if you're right. And I think you're probably right. I think this is what's happening. So there we are screaming about tearing down statues and each of us is claiming to be the biggest victim in this current paradigm, which is a bit of a nightmare, when really every single one of us is marked for this.
Right. And I would say it's important to know the history, right? I mean, I think knowing that history is actually important because looking towards, I would say looking towards countries that have been dealing with structural adjustment, right? Because this is all running through the World Bank and the IMF. you know, we're all about to be structurally adjusted, right? Like we're used to the global north structurally adjusting the global south. Well, now we're all in for it, right? And so it really behooves those of us who feel like maybe we're coming at a superior angle to sort of look at resistance movements, look at indigenous resistance movements to colonialism, look at resistance movements to enslavement, look at to marinage, right? Look at the Caribbean slave revolts. Look at all of these things, because those are the people who knew how to take on these systems and to try to not be erased by them.
But answer me this.
We're very close to that.
Sorry, Alison, for interrupting. This is a really good point. Answer me this if you can, please. What happens? I mean, you're speaking to an Irishman, and I can spend hours and hours talking about the Easter 1916 rising, the rebels, how eventually the Irish Free State came about. But Ireland is in some respects worse now than it was when it was under the jackboot of the British Empire. What about India? What about Gandhi? What happens? What happens to these movements that have some success against these colonial powers? But it ultimately ends up going, you know, it seems to be just a deviation from where the elites wanted to go. Ultimately, that deviation ends and the path continues towards tyranny. Why? Why is that? Do you have any idea? I don't know why. That was a rather strange question.
My perspective on this is, and this is what's been interesting to me, because I tried to organize with education stuff for a number of years and it didn't really progress. And then I tried to organize like with folks who were doing organizing with the poor and people in addiction, because we're a center of the heroin epidemic. And that got to a certain point, but then that didn't quite, people weren't quite with me. And then the people who ended up being immediately with me when all of this happened were people who were coming from a holistic health perspective, and also people of faith, which is really, and not just Christian faith, all energy healers, all sorts of people. And those were neither areas that I come from. That was not really my experience. I'm not really connected into either of those spheres. And I was really kind of intrigued by that was the audience. This was an audience I never even occurred to me that would be an audience for this research. And I think moving forward, what I feel is that, like in learning from them, and is that this is I do feel like what we're in is a spiritual battle of ideas and spirit and heart. And that people have been waging this for many years. And part of it is, how do we define success? And, if we understand the world as sort of this energetic system, like, and we're all in different places. I mean, my blog is called Wrench in the Gears. And so we're all in the machine. I'm not casting blame. We're all in some level of the machine, right? Like my husband works at a university, which allows me to do this, but that's a very big part of the machine. I'm not saying, you have to be pure to participate in this, but you have to position yourself and then do the best, like put your intentions out with what you have. And John Trudell, I would recommend anyone who's not familiar with his work. He was I think he's a prophetic voice for this time. And he was a spoken word poet and a leader in the American Indian movement. And he spoke very much about predator energy and these systems. He was part of the Alcatraz occupation, and he lost his wife and children. The FBI probably burnt his house down, and he lost much. But he said, our responsibility is to use the intelligence given to us by the creator to go up against the machine of tech. He called it tech-no-logic, technologic. And he said that's our charge, is to go up against this, as many have done before. And so, I think I'm just cautious of sort of saying like it can never get better, because clearly like we're standing on the shoulders of all those who have gone before. And it's our responsibility to face this and to carry it as long as we can. Because if we don't, then anybody behind us they're not going to have anything. So
there's no doubt about
that.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. Yeah. I phrased my question very badly. I was just lamenting the fact that tyrants have been kicked out of places before. But then after a brief, kind of honeymoon period, things got very bad again. And I've always wondered about that. I wondered what happened to my country. But no, you gave a very good answer. Alison McDowell is our guest, wrenchinthegears.com. We've had a lot of guests in recent times. They've not been as eloquent. They've not looked into this as greatly as Alison. Mark Windows has done. You mentioned Sandy Adams earlier on. They're on the ball as Alison is looking into this. Wrenchinthegears.com. We're looking at a future where it's almost unthinkable if this endures. I mean, I've been covering false flag terror attacks for years. I've been covering how central banks have bankrupted countries for years, deliberately bankrupted countries, loaning countries money, mm-hmm. knowing they could never pay it back, so that they could then get in there with their NGOs and everything else and do the things that you described in the first part of this conversation. And it's only in recent years that I began to understand how all of these things, you know, wars in the Middle East, how all of these things are connected, that we're being driven towards a technocratic future, a paradigm that's unimaginable. Transhumanism, you talk a lot about this as well. And we don't want to scare the listeners, but if we don't address this, do you want to, and I know you're not a science fiction writer, and I don't say that for a laugh, what would it be like in 15, 20 years if we don't halt this, if we don't get together and do something about it? What will the world be like for people? I mean, we hear about social crediting. We hear about, you know, chips in people to allow them go places. What sort of place are they planning for us? What sort of world will it be?
Well, a few years ago, my kid, they were like, you know, and my poor family, right? They don't quite get me. I mean, they love me, but they don't quite get me. And they're like, you need to write this like a story with people, Mom, because people don't get you.
So that's where I'm going with it. Yeah.
If you look on my blog, there's something called Building Sanctuary. There's a 7-part series. If you Google on Wrench in the Gears in the search bar, Building Sanctuary, it will come up. And it's sort of my vision of what this will look like. You know, ultimately, and I wrote a post sort of saying what comes after the left-right divide, because I'm feeling like increasingly it's not as relevant and helpful in terms of organizing. I think the split is going to be between people who feel very strongly about being connected to natural systems and to human-based systems, and then to people who will either eagerly or ruefully be pushed into this transhumanist program. And I do believe that we need to understand that these injections that are coming, which it will be a series, you know, it's not going to be a one-off, involve nanotechnology and nanorobotics. And, you know, this was all new to me. I spent, you know, several months just trying to look in. There's giant institutes of nanotech and graphene and injectables. And, you know, people know far more about it than myself, but this idea that the World Economic Forum describes the plan for an internet of bodies. And even the EU talks about the internet of humans. And so they really do want to consolidate us and take away our free will and, you know, advance. Essentially, you know, I did a webinar with my friend Joseph, who is had a full career in AI and video game design and blockchain. And he knows all of these things and was starting to, the past 5 years, realize how it was all sort of going awry. And I had the finance. So we've collaborated on a webinar that talks about this, but is that turning the world into essentially an augmented reality video game. And if you look up Niantic, you know, the Pokemon Go, that was the test balloon, but that was backed, that company was backed by InQtel, which is the CIA's venture capital arm. And this overlays with smart city technologies, which, you know, many cities globally are becoming smart cities with Internet of Things sensors, yep. And that we will be tracked with sensors either initially on our phones or tablets and eventually maybe RFID chips, and then maybe eventually just this hydrogel nanorobotics, that we will resonate with these digital systems. And then ultimately perhaps be subsumed, our physical bodies, to be confined, like right now we're being confined in our homes, you know, maybe at some point we'll be confined to dormitories, you know, or some, you know, efficient housing. And then our digital avatars will be walking around, or we'll have robots, you know, that we'll be remotely managing. There was a video promoting people with profound disabilities working, quote unquote, in cafes through remote robotics.
Let me jump in there. And I say this with the utmost respect, because I've been reading you all day and watching your videos. And the last 10, 15 years, I spent speaking to people like Jim Mars, rest in peace, who would be very interested in listening to you today if Jim was alive. David Icke, who's written many books on transhumanism. And I'm sure if he was to hear this, would be very interested. I'm very open-minded to this. But what you're describing there, the possibility of human beings being confined to a room while their avatars would inhabit some digital world. I can see it. And I remember speaking to a guy from NASA a few years ago on the program called Rich Terreal, very famous guy. And he talked about the holographic nature of reality and where this might be going. Amazing. But I've got to say this, and this is the big preamble because I think you're great. But a lot of my listeners are saying, bullshit, this is crazy. This can't happen. How could this possibly happen? You said there a minute ago that you've got two sets of people, the human-based systems people, that'd be you and me, Alison, and you've got these other people who will take this willingly. There will be people saying, no way. And they might say, no way, and they're entitled to think that. Then their next question might be, when? When is this meant to be, if it does come about? You know, one of our listeners is saying on Twitter, sounds like an episode of Black Mirror. It does. Yeah, I mean, predictive programming.
And this is the thing. Like, I can hope. I mean, what I try to present is that I can give a good intelligence briefing about what the headspace is of these individuals, what their goal is.
Yeah.
And I think it would be not helpful to discount what they say they're planning on doing. Now, they may not be able to achieve it all. And I would say there's a very good book that I recommend for context. It's called Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine. And it's a military history of the internet. And in that, I mean, one of the individuals featured is Norbert Wiener, who was sort of he was the father of cybernetics and AI and was sort of a functioning human computer in World War II. And in his later years, realized what he had done in terms of building the implications of robotics and artificial intelligence on the human race and was speaking out and was cast out as a dissident over it. But, you know, so that's, they still haven't achieved it, right? I mean, he was saying this in the 50s and they haven't achieved it. So that's comforting. But I think we still can't dismiss the capabilities of the global military industrial complex.
My listeners agree with you. Listen, my listeners say, look, and these are bright, smart comments coming in, no pun intended, smart comments. Here's Ian. He says, Richie, this is where we're going with soccer. Virtual reality headsets in your living room. Your avatar will be in the stadium next to your mate's avatar, and he's in his living room. I made a joke about this when they banned people from going to the stadiums back in March. I made a stupid joke about it. I said it won't be long before people pay to have their digital image sitting in a seat at the stadium. And I was joking because I don't know anything. That's Ian. I mean, it's feasible. You're right, Alison.
But the thing I think I find frustrating, I'm not a trained economist. I'm not trained in any of my background is art history and cultural landscapes. All right. So I don't profess I'm taught on the job. But, you know, when folks are like capitalism is dying, we've reached the brink, we've hit the wall, the global assets, resources, it's all going to fall apart. And then some new version of leftist politics is going to roll in. Like what they've missed is that capitalism has jumped into the virtual world. It's broken the wall. It's jumped into the gaming and reality. And what I didn't realize is when my kid was littler, we had these things called Webkins, which were stuffed animal toys, and they came with a little tag, and you would open a code and open a VR world, like a video game world, and you could buy things for them. Like you could play games and furnish a room. And that was virtual capitalism. And it didn't even occur to me at the time. I mean, it wasn't anything I was that into, but I was like, looking back, they've been grooming kids. And right now, Class Dojo and these different classroom token economies, they're grooming kids to live in a digital script, a behavioral script world. And so if you can imagine the idea of capitalism is reliant on growth, continued growth in a world that can't continue to really grow, to have consumption at the levels people need to consume to keep the global economy growing, you virtualize it, right? And not that there's no cost in that, because clearly there's a cost to run the server farms and there's an electrical and water cost in that. But it's not the same to own a virtual outfit as it is to own a real outfit that's made by real people. And so when you look, and you can even have multiple avatars, right? Like you can represent yourself in different ways to different groups of people. And so from a capitalist standpoint, that's a bonanza, right? Like you could have three different human beings attached to one human being and each of them consuming items and buying virtual goods.
This is incredible.
It's twisted if you think about it. But I mean, and the other piece of this that people need to understand is that this world, it's a military world. The world that is built in virtual reality is a military world. It is foundationally military. And that's why Yasha Levine's book is so important. But it's not just the military. It's actually with the entertainment industry. So it's this crazy wedding of video games, entertainment, the military, and behavioral science and behavioral economics in a way that we are living in a world that we no longer control.
And in the near future, sorry, Alison, in the near future, it makes perfect sense to me, if you're right, for them to introduce more and more and increasingly common pandemics. So the more you do that, the more you scare the bejesus out of people. And as this is going on, the virtual reality technology is becoming so good that I might be able to step into a suit and put a helmet on me, and I might feel 100% like I'm at the bar with Alison and Alison's husband. I might actually feel that I'm there. It might feel so real as to be totally real. You see, this is... And I know those virtual reality suits and headsets already exist. It's there. And, you know, I'm getting the impression from you, you talk about capitalist bonanza because of the opportunities for this, to market this. But I'm... Because you mentioned the spiritual battle, I'm guessing that you think money is one aspect of it and power, but there's something else going on, something that goes beyond money. I'm not pushing you down that avenue if you don't want to go down it, but some of my guests, very learned, like yourself, self-made in terms of, you know, acquiring the knowledge, they feel that it goes beyond money and it does go to right to the heart of what we are and why we're here. What do you think?
I mean, I would agree with you there. I don't, like I said, I'm learning a lot of this, and I think this is something I want to emphasize for people, if this seems hard or bizarre, is that part of what we need to do is be able to take in new information and sit with it, right? Figure out where it relates to the other information we have, and then incorporate it, and then or not, and move on. And so a lot of what I've been learning the past 6 or 7 months in the pandemic has been a lot of that piece, right? And for me, you know, I've come at things that I've long believed that an accounting around, you know, indigenous sovereignty and enslavement, like, is a central piece even before the pandemic. But to me, it feels like it is people who are of the land and who are connected to natural systems. That is the way to, that is an appropriate response. That's the antithesis. And that, you know, I have folks that have talked to me about balance, right? And the yin yang and these things. So I think everything right now is profoundly out of balance, and it's a matter of coming back into balance. So I don't know. I'm still learning, but I do feel like in my heart that this is more, it's, I mean, if it were just about money, people keep saying, well, why would Bill Gates be doing all these things? He has all the money. Well, I don't think it, at that point, clearly it's not just about the money anymore. It's about power, but it very well could be other things. And for me, for the most part, if you actually look at my research, I have this in my heart. But what I do is I spend a lot of time following LinkedIn profiles and conference papers and watching the World Bank on YouTube. So like I follow things, like I actually follow very concrete things. And these things of the heart, you can't put, you know, down in a bibliography, right? They just live there in you. So I talk, in my non-research time, I work at a botanic garden that's, you know, is what keeps me centered on the land. And sometimes I write about that. That's sort of my counterbalance. And that's the stuff that's not quantifiable.
You're a very good writer, by the way. You really are. You're very readable. And that's as good a compliment as I could give anybody. Alison McDowell is our guest. And we're talking about a technocratic, futuristic society. That the way is being paved for this future world. And it's being achieved. If it is achieved, it'll be across many different agendas. And can I ask you this? Is it a source of frustration to you that these plans are brazen in the respect that they are there for everybody to see on the websites of the World Economic Forum, and not just the World Economic Forum, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation? It's there. It's right there. And it's not that you've interpreted it in a way to suit your argument. You haven't. It is there. And yet, it's a struggle to get anybody to take a look at it. It's a case of shaking their heads. You know, come on, that's a bit mad, Richie. A bit crazy, that. But it is there in black and white, and it doesn't require any translation, right?
Well, I think what it requires is for people to be willing to sort of understand that very foundational beliefs of what they thought about the world aren't what they thought, right? And that's not an easy thing to do. And I would say, you know, you know, I've been able to make these sort of global connections largely because early on, I actually made a connection with Corey Morningstar, and I would just like to sort of lift up her work with the Wrong Kind of Green website, because she had all of this is running through the Sustainable Development Goals, right? And a big chunk of those are anti-poverty and managing people, but then the other piece is financializing and controlling the environment. So all of these sensors and tracking, they're planning to do it to every thing in the planet. And just, you know, like they want to put tags on the great white sharks and track them around, like we're the next ones up.
Yeah.
So, you know, and she was not listened to either, for, you know, and castigated, because everyone wants to believe in the Green New Deals and Extinction Rebellion and that they're going to be on the winning team for the right side. And so it's very hard to sort of stop and go, oh, wow. It's a little embarrassing, like for people, like I get it. Like if you've put yourself into it, you feel mournful about it. You feel maybe a little bit like you should have known better, and which isn't true. I'm not saying that is, but it's hard. Like people have to really be willing to go there and to own that, like, it's not what you thought. And then, so now what, right? What does my life look like now that many of these things I thought that I'm invested in being part of me are not what I thought? And how do I reinvent myself? And so I think that's the struggle that we're asking people to pick that up. And, you know, what I'm realizing is like, not everyone can come.
Yeah, this is it.
For everybody. I mean, you can, and a good friend, you know, he said, you can't change people. You can put your intentions out and then they will go where they need to go. And no one person can change a different person. They can just live their truth. And so, I would say I've lost a lot in this. I've lost people who I thought would stand with me who have not been able to, but I found a great fellowship of people who can see the world with the clarity that I have thus far. Not that I have all the answers, but that as I see it now, and who are willing to engage with it. I think that's the thing. I don't care that I want to be right. I want someone who will think through it with me. And I've found those people, and I'm very grateful for that.
Maybe the entity or entities behind the agenda has maybe overplayed its hand or their hand, because the coronavirus story is falling apart at the seams. And I'm even noticing on mainstream television and radio here in the UK, I'm seeing people getting on to talk programmes to say to presenters, this is crap, this is nonsense. The testing is nonsense. People are not sick. The hospitals are empty. And I wonder if there's hope there that this might be, I mean, you mentioned earlier on that they've been trying to do it for a long time, but have thus far have failed. Maybe the coronavirus hoax, because it is a hoax, even if there is a virus, this is a hoax. Maybe this falling apart at the seams maybe is an opportunity for us, Alison. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I would encourage people to look at like DARPA's relationship with Profusa and the biosensors. You know, yeah. They've created global markets. And, you know, I said this early on when this happened, that just by following all the rules to think that we'll be safe is naive. I think there are people who come from, oppressed and targeted communities, Black and brown communities, at least in the U.S., who know that like following all the rules never makes you safe. In empire, it just doesn't. You can be the best person and still be shot on the street by, you know, the state. it just happens. And so, you know, I think a lot of people want to cling to that if we just follow all the rules that they tell us, that we'll be okay. And the reality is that we have huge bioweapons programs, and that at any point they can either unleash something real or not, you know, or made up. And make up the data to go along with it to suit their purposes. And I would say, you know, look at Goldman Sachs. They have something called the Effective Lockdown Index with Google. Okay. It's not the coronavirus lockdown index. It's not a COVID-19 lockdown index. It's just a general effective lockdown index. When Goldman Sachs, who is all about pay for success, wants to lock down the global economy, now they can, right? Under whatever grounds, whether it's going to be straight up deadly real or faux real or you know, a psyop, they can do it. If we allow it. And I think we just have to be prepared for that, because, you know, you don't set up a global biosecurity state and not use it. and yeah, look at the Commons Project. The Commons Project was developed with Rockefeller backing. They've set up health tracking on blockchain, your mobility tracking, and your access to education and employment. They're not putting that in a drawer unless people actively confront that. And that is the piece people are missing, is that I think many people, is that it's not, they need for everyone to be on blockchain, which is a decentralized ledger, to run these human capital bonds. And if it were optional, they wouldn't. They would not be able to scale it. If they can implement, and it has to be global, because globalization 4.0, telepresence, haptic robotic labor, is going to be you competing, someone in the UK competing against someone in the Philippines, against someone in India, against someone in Zimbabwe. Like, that's the plan. They have to get everybody on blockchain so that they can run these AI micro work platforms. If it's voluntary, people won't do it. And so if they can implement a global biosecurity police state and call you a terrorist if you are not plugged into the blockchain, that's what they're going to do. And that's what people need to understand, the seriousness of this, is that it's a system that is built on debt, finance, and human capital. If we're fighting COVID, the individual's outbreak, we've missed the point. What we need to fight is the biosecurity apparatus. And I will say that a lot of it is running through Israel. The IDF Unit 8200, they have alumni that are running social impact accelerators that are health tech. The Israel is running the COVID reopen program in the state of Rhode Island in the US. And Matthew Gould, who is the head of NHSX, the healthcare platform in the UK, was the ambassador to Israel and then came back to digital media, culture and sport and outcomes lab. And you can bet your patootie that contact tracing is all about installing behavior tracking apps on people for their health. So it's much bigger. People need to understand that piece. Human capital, biosecurity tracking in a police state, and how it connects to AI labor markets.
And is the immediate next step then, you mentioned earlier, the immediate next step for those behind it has got to be the rollout of several different types of vaccine. That's got to be the next step. And I've seen the same research material you've seen about nanotechnology in vaccines. It isn't a conspiracy theory. It's the truth. It's absolutely the truth and nothing but the truth. And I echo what you said. Why invent it? Why develop it unless you plan to use it? They plan to use it. So I'm listening. I'm gripped with what you're telling me. The obvious next step is early 2021, get this vaccine. I'll tell you something. They are screaming for the vaccine here in the UK. People, I mean.
Really?
They're screaming for it, yeah.
I mean, people have trust. They want to trust their government, I think. Or they want to trust the people they think they vote for. Like, nobody's voting in Davos, right? Nobody voted for Klaus Schwab or Bill Gates or Piero Mediar or any of these folks. And they don't know that. And And the thing I would just emphasize is that, you know, I know there's a lot of concern saying it's not a chip. It's not, you know, the quantum dot tattoos, and isn't it? They don't actually need anything other than a biometric identity setup tied to a device with a QR code. The world doesn't have to, can be very different, an open air digital prison, but not look that different. It can just be a world run on simple QR codes, which is not sophisticated technology. You don't need nanorobotics to run the open air prison. You don't. And it's already happening in, you know, in Australia and New Zealand with and I think UK is starting with the QR codes. That's the early phase. They don't need you with the hydrogel nanorobotics 6G right off. They just need to get you to accept it.
You are 100% right about the QR codes. Politicians on television and radio here in the last few weeks and doctors have been talking up the QR codes as part of the new NHS track and trace application. You're absolutely right. This is where they want us to go. They want us to, they want you and me and your husband and my better half to go to the cinema and to be scanned as we're walking in, and for the entrance to be determined on whether or not we've got the right data, whether we've got the right vaccine, whether we've been tested or not. You are absolutely right. You don't need at this stage to have a chip implanted under your hand. It's
I mean,
there.
The other piece of this that's important, now I've said that the pay for success finance, as I understand it, it's at least three data collection nodes. One is education, so digital education platforms and slash training, because they're going to start doing virtual apprenticeships with virtual reality and all this stuff to get ready for haptic robotic labor. So that's one. The other is healthcare and mental health care, right? So here in the US, we had a very disproportionate impact of deaths, serious adverse effects on people, the Black community and certain indigenous communities, the Navajo Nation in particular. And I don't know how it felt very targeted. Okay. So those are both communities that have, due to like epigenetic trauma, long-term, like multiple generation trauma, chronic illness, are predisposed to chronic illness. And also as well as like environmental racism and stress and other aspects of social aspects. What's going to happen with the healthcare is that they're going to push preventative health, all the talk about comorbidities,
yeah.
Right? They're going to use what happened, and they're going to say in the coming years, you better meet your step counts.
Yes.
You better do your yoga. You better eat right. In fact, the Imperial College London that had the initial flaws study, their R&D program has something called the DNA nudge band, where you get your DNA and it's a wearable bracelet that you scan to access what food you're allowed to eat.
Yeah.
Well, they frame it that it's what food is good for you. But once here, they're talking about putting food stamps on blockchain. So essentially, I fully envision that there will be only certain things you'll be allowed to eat if you have a tie to your DNA. And the NHS bought 5.5 or 6.5 million of these tied to COVID.
And okay. We haven't even
so they're
begun.
They're harvesting your DNA. They're going to set you up with wearable technology to say what you can eat. They're probably going to tell you how much you have to walk, you know. And these are all very real things that are tied to, like in London, there's something called the Partnership for Healthy Cities. And this is Michael Bloomberg. And Bloomberg was with Ghebreyesus and the World Health Organization and climate change and smart cities and the smart city global police state. I would really encourage people. Michael Bloomberg is just, if not perhaps more dangerous than Bill Gates. So people need to understand how this is all going to play out, that it might sound nice. And what I've said is, you know, I work at this public garden, we have a walking trail. Well, what happens if someone comes into us and says, well, we'd love for you to be a preferred provider. Could you just put this QR code on your trail so that when the people who are on, you know, medical assistance, you know, they can check in that they've walked their appropriate amounts? It doesn't have to be a radical change, but there's a very different thing between being a welcoming public space where people can come and walk and do their own thing by their own choice and having a prescription from your doctor. It's a very different thing.
We've seen it here already about diabetes. They've gotten into it here, the National Health Service. You mentioned Imperial College London. It's already been mooted that people who are overweight, that they take that seriously, and for the betterment or for the good of the entire population, they should lose some weight fairly quickly so that they don't put a burden on the NHS when the virus picks up again. Staggering stuff. They said people should have, they should go on to 800 calorie a day crash diet courses, which could kill people. And you can find that, any of our listeners, who don't understand that, just look at the Times newspaper here in London, look at the Telegraph. Yeah, they're doing that already. This, you mentioned it was brilliant that you brought it up, preventative, that you will bear the responsibility to look after yourself for the good of everybody, not to put a burden on the state. And of course, if you don't do that, that's where social crediting comes in, doesn't it? That's where, well, you're not doing it. You're not doing the steps, Alison. You're not looking after yourself. Right. So your social activities need to be curtailed a bit.
Right. And we're not paying for your diabetic shoes, you know, because you didn't do your thing. Like maybe next quarter you step it up. And the problem about this is that it's never looking at the structural nature of the problem, right? That the person is working several jobs, you know, that they don't have any fresh food, affordable food in their community, that, you know, there are many elements that affect the social determinants of health that are beyond individual choice. And yet these systems will be all about individual choice of getting data on a dashboard, a leaderboard, and moving you from this point to that point so that JP Morgan Chase or UBS Bank or QB Insurance or Kaiser Permanente or whomever can make a buck off of your life. And then the terrible thing about this, and if you watch the movie The Big Short and about the derivatives and the is that once they securitize the debt, people are betting against it. So someone's betting against, like, that you have a good health outcome, right? And that's what's so sickening about, like, all of these, you know, betting on toddlers. And, you know, I didn't even get into these surveillance play tables. Somebody's betting against you, you know? And it's never, if you create a global market that is profitable in managing trauma and chronic illness and poverty and mental health difficulties, you are only going to grow that market. Yeah. But, and manage it.
Shorting people. I mean, this is where you came in at the very beginning. And listen, don't worry about not getting into the educational aspect of it again, the young children. We will, of course, make time if you want to come back. That is, because you might not want to come back. But if you do want to come back, we'll make time. We'll make time again to pick it up again in a month's time, because it's a lot for people to take in. And that's why I tend to do 45, 50 minutes. And some of my listeners say to me, ah, Richie, you could have kept Alison on forever. Of course I could. But this is new to a lot of people and they can't process this stuff. And it's better to do it in stages, I think. But you came in with that, shorting people. I mean, this is staggering. And yet, it's real. I know it's real. I know it's there. I know it's happening. And a number of listeners on Twitter have likened this futuristic landscape to Spielberg's film Ready Player One. And I, again, just to give a nod to the late, great Jim Mars, Jim was talking about predictive programming in the media, in film, in television, Alison, long before anybody else was. He could see that coming, you know, that we would be induced to accept it subconsciously by seeing it on the big screen.
Yeah. And the author of the book that that movie was based on is from Austin, right? Yeah, so that's Dell. And it's also Michael Bloomberg has put unhoused people in Austin on blockchain already. So, yeah, they want you to fight to save the virtual world. I mean, that's the premise behind that book, is that you will fight to save the virtual world because the current world is done. It's killed. We've killed it. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that you know, that we band together, but we do it from a place of love and an understanding of the history, that this is a colonial project, right? And we kind of wrecked things to begin with, right? And so now we have to try to start to set things back in balance. But it's going to take a ton of education for people, and people need time to process it. You're right, because it's a lot to understand and then to be willing to let go of the old and move on, because it's not, I think many respects people are want to pull back to an old way, here, you know, the Constitution. And I'm like, you know, our Constitution was always set up to preference, you know, white male landowners, that, so we need something better. We need something. And I know, you know, they're talking in Canada about like a republic that's more balanced there, the Republic of Canada. And, yeah, we need something better.
Listen,
but we'll get there. I believe in us. I believe most people would not want this future if they knew.
If they knew. And I think there's a great opportunity with increasing anger, not hate. It's not hate. It's anger. As people realize the arbitrary measures to tackle a virus that doesn't kill anybody are ridiculous and increasingly farcical, I think there is an opportunity. Look, this radio program, not to brag, we've always had a very big listenership. It's almost doubled since March, to the point where it's difficult to carry on streaming it because of the amount of data, ironically, the transfer of data every month. And it is a lot of bewildered people. And you'll find this yourself on your own YouTube channel. You'll find it on your website. There is opportunity as people realise that they are being had. Alison, we've got 90 seconds left. I've mentioned your website and I will, of course, mention it again. There is a YouTube channel, of course. So give us a plug for the YouTube channel. They just need to look for Alison McDowell. Is that right?
Yep. It's just Alison McDowell YouTube. And it has Sandy's speech about the education and the blockchain from Saturday. And let's go forward. And we need to find a way for those people who are starting to understand what it is to gently shift, right? Because it's going to be a hard shift for someone to make, to realize that maybe what they thought at the beginning of this crisis in January isn't what they thought, right? We have to be gracious in that and bring people along.
Brilliant. Wrenchinthegears.com. Alison, thanks for your time today there in Pennsylvania. Lovely to have you on.
Love it. Thank you so much. It was great.
Great work. Thank you. And I look forward to the next time. Alison McDowell there, wrenchinthegears.com. And you'll find Alison very quickly on YouTube. There's only one Alison McDowell. Right. Thanks to her for that. Fascinating. And I know for many people who listen to this for the first time, it's very difficult to process a lot of that. But if you go to the website and read it, I think sometimes it's easier to read it to get a grip on it. But I know you got the central premise of where they want to take the world. It's real. I wish it wasn't. I'd love to be arguing with her and hammering away at her, but it's real. It really is. It's exactly 90 seconds to 7 o'clock. It's time for me to go. Thanks to Alison. Thanks to Gerald Salente, trendsresearch.com. Tomorrow, it's you. You're the star. We'll have a chat, you and me, me and you. You can chat about what Alison was talking about or anything you like. That's tomorrow. Closing out the programme with Kaylee from Marillion. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday. From the BBG, it's adieu. Speak tomorrow.